I'm always conscious on days like today. I've grown up and learning about the atrocities of war, as John's reflected this morning. Maybe some of you, those are not just memories that you've been taught or learnt, but actually experiences that you went through. I remember at school being taught about events and dates and different things that went on. Happened at different times, obviously particularly World War One, World War Two, as often the major wars that are communicated, but obviously since then and many others have taken place. I was reflecting as a child, I can vaguely remember something of the Gulf War, and I suppose that's probably my first personal experience of a war taking place in my lifetime. See, the war on terror sparked by 9/11 is something now very much in the vocabulary of our time. And there seems to be various organisations intent on the destruction of life. Again, part and parcel, very sadly, if you will, of life today. As I said, I'm very conscious on days like today of the relentless cycle where the human race is concerned that we seem to sadly be living in, that is a story of death and destruction, and individuals wanting to do away with other individuals. And so there's the real awfulness to today, and there will be to tomorrow as well, as I'm sure many of us will pause at 11 o'clock. And I think it can raise a whole load of questions for us as well, not just in society, but as believers. Raise questions as to how do we work through this? How do we understand it? How do we engage in society's practices in terms of remembering, in terms of responding to the things that take place? I believe in the midst of it all, though, we can find hope. And I believe in the midst of it all, that's something that we need to hold on to. And not just kind of in your back pocket, but no, actually it needs something we need to have front and center in terms of our lives, that there is a hope that is greater than anything that this world will throw at us. There is a hope that is greater than anything that can happen to us. And so this morning we're going to look at possibly one of the greatest kind of questions really that comes out of a conversation with God. One that was part of a simple conversation one evening in a garden, but that would have an eternal impact. I'm going to read from Matthew 26, a passage guessing very familiar to us, or many of us, Jesus in Gethsemane. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Going a little further, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Can you men keep watch with me for 1 hour?" he asked Peter. "Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." He went away a second time and prayed, "My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done." When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. Then he returned to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour has come and the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." So we find ourselves in the garden. It's crunch time for Jesus. We're in the end game now, if you will. And this is what Jesus' ministry has been building to. It's also, I think, one of the last moments where he is able to actually back out. It's from this point on that things really seem to get locked in terms of the events of the coming hours. And if we just ask the question, kind of, what is going on here? What are some of the things, some of the observations we could make? You've got the disciples who are really now starting to fall apart. It's beginning. This sense of this trajectory of where they're going to head over the coming hours. They're unraveling. It almost begins to pick up pace from here on. Jesus appears to want out, as we've just heard, and we might kind of go, but hold on, he's the Son of God. What's going on there? Surely this is what he's come for. How could he be thinking these thoughts? You've got the relationship between Jesus, as I say, with God the Father. You've got the relationship between Jesus and his disciples. And then you've got almost the behind the scenes here as well. We find ourselves in Gethsemane. But there's a foreboding of what is to come and what is coming from elsewhere. The large crowd armed with swords and clubs that we're going to read about in verse 47 would have been at this time probably they'd have started to gather. They'd have been starting to mass to prepare themselves for their part in this tale. And yet before we get to any of that, there's this intimate moment here in the garden where we see Jesus pouring out his heart. Verse 37 captures almost that agonizing sorrow of where he finds himself. Commentator Douglas Hare emphasizes how, you know, this is key in our understanding of who Jesus is. If we're going to have a sound Christology, which is the word used to kind of talk about the understanding of the person and the nature of Christ, it's in this moment that we realize, it reminds us that Jesus was fully human. We affirm the divinity of God. He is God's Son. But also the fact that he was human. He came in flesh to us. And Hare puts it this way. He says, if Jesus was not fully human, the cross was an empty pantomime. It was just a show. And so in this moment, verse 39, Jesus falls on his face and he is in anguish and distress. Maybe emotions that we can relate to in part in terms of our humanity. And so it's that sense that we find Jesus in the worst crisis since, well, back in the start of Matthew's gospel, in the wilderness, when he was tempted. We've also got this warning here from Jesus. Verse 41, he says, watch and pray so you will not fall into temptation. He's talking, I think, both to himself, but also to his disciples. So there's a whole load going on in this moment that seemingly could just be a guy in a garden of an evening. I love as you look at the start of the way Jesus prays, he says, my Father. Mark's Gospel uses the words Abba, Father. It's that, as I'm sure maybe many of us are aware, it's Aramaic, it's Daddy. It's that closeness, that connection. This isn't some business transaction. No, there is a close bond. There is a genuine relation here. It's in these moments that Jesus doesn't hold back from just telling God how it is. One view I read was almost Jesus prays here like no one has ever prayed before. Because there is a rawness about it. In Luke's account, blood dropped from his brow because of the intensity of what is taking place. And so I think almost front and center is an aside in part, but a real important reminder to us, prayer is a necessity, if not an essential, when times are tough. And we see that in Jesus here. Jesus is facing an intolerable situation. And in that, he is honest with God. He tells God how it is. I didn't know John was going to have the reading shared from the Beatitudes. I read a book the last couple of weeks reflecting on it. And in it, the writer talks about the concept of blessed are the persecuted. And writing from a Western culture, he kind of asked that question, do we really understand what that means? It's a concept that actually is very alien to most of us. Or maybe we kind of interact in it or we are aware of it in a small way, but actually it's something that we've never really had to deal with. And in this time of trial for Jesus, he converses with God and he's asking God to move and do something initially, to take his pain away from him. And it echoes, I think, something of what we brought out when we looked at Jonah some weeks ago, in terms of the relationship that Jesus had meant in that moment that he had something to cling on to. Obviously, one of the big things that I think comes out of this prayer is the fact that Jesus doesn't actually get what he asks for. It's a classic example, if not one of the greatest examples, of an unanswered prayer. I know some of the life groups have been working through the prayer course by Pete Gregg. We've been using it on a Sunday at 5 p.m. with the young people who gather. Last Sunday we were looking at the session on unanswered prayer. And reminds us that the prayer is not a wish list. Something that maybe we kind of, well, we know that. But again, we need to remember that. The prayer is not something that we can just come and say, this is what I want, these three things. And therefore, if I say it in a certain manner or in a certain way, we're going to get it. And that may raise questions for us, particularly when we pray for things that are selfless from our perspective, or people who are really in need. I don't know if you've ever had that occasion where someone says, I know how you feel. And they say to you, I know exactly how you feel in this situation. The reality is they probably don't. Very rarely can someone, I think, say that and completely connect with us. Because we see life from our own perspective, from our own point of view. Yet, when Jesus comes to pray in this passage, verse 39, going a little further, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, my Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. When it comes to prayers being unanswered, Jesus does actually understand what it's like. God's all powerful. He can do anything. His son's asking this question, what's more. Surely he should respond and let him off the hook and answer his request. The writer of the Hebrews, chapter 5, verse 7, records it says, during the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. He was heard. But as the writer goes on in verse 9, son though he was, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. We can get close to God. We can seek to live a holy life. But that doesn't mean we get what we want. Doesn't mean the answers we might look for are always there for us. As one preacher once put it, it's a profound mystery before which we must bow. I think the reflection that I've been working through, then we look at Jesus' prayer and his unanswered prayer here, is that actually I wonder whether it's not entirely what we think it is. Jesus says, not as I will, but as you will, verse 39. May this cup be taken from me. Cup being that metaphor for death. The Hebrew scriptures would talk about the cup of God's wrath. But I don't believe Jesus is talking about an escape plan here. Instead, about God establishing his kingdom. And if there's a way that doesn't require the Messiah to suffer to public shame, to an excruciating death, and I think ultimately his father turning his back on his son. Jesus said, if there's any way for that to happen without this course of events needing to work through, then can we go for that option? I don't believe Jesus was in any way questioning what needed to happen. In that nanosecond though, Jesus was saying, if there is another way, now's the time to reveal it. Now's the time to show your hand, if you will. Because ultimately, Jesus' heart is to do the will of the Father. Romans 5:19, Paul writes, "For just as though the disobedience of the one man, the many were made sinners, so also through the obedience of the one man, the many will be made righteous." I read this, it's the sense that in what Jesus did, his most important sacrifice was his, not his blood, but his obedience. His willingness to respond to what God was asking of him. And so in Gethsemane, we see this reversal, if you will, of Eden. Jesus aligning his will with that of the Father. Now, there's much more that could be pulled out of this. I mean, I referenced the disciples, for example, and how they kind of fed into this. You look at kind of what's coming. You look at kind of Jesus' warning. I think the heart of it for me, though, is that Jesus here spends time with the Father and he's ready for what is to come. And he's open to what God has ahead of him. As I was preparing, it struck me that if you've never read this account, I'm going to take a guess that most of us here today will have read it, probably many times, and reflected on it on numerous occasions. But if you've never read this, you could be forgiven for thinking that actually there's not much happening here. I mean, there's no action taking place in this passage. There's no fireworks. There's no cast of thousands. There's no great journey from this land to another. No miracles to marvel at. There's no transformation from sinner to saint. Seemingly, there just appears to be a guy praying and getting quite upset, really, and not least because his friends have fallen asleep on him. Yet in these moments, everything is happening. The power of what we witness in this passage, I would go as far as to say, I think it's almost beyond what we can comprehend. Maybe that's just me speaking personally. But this conversation with God, the rawness, the personal nature of it, the fact that it doesn't hold anything back, the fact that Jesus lays it all out, even with his Father, because he understands the relationship that he has and what's being asked of him. And I pray that each of us will maybe take a moment just to reflect and go, actually, how can I capture even just an ounce of that? Of that desire to go in a messed up world we live in. God, what is on your heart? So as you spend stillness in your daily quiet time, maybe, in that moment to go, God, what is it that is on your heart for me today? As you're driving to pick up your shopping or visit a friend, rather than putting the radio on, actually just taking that moment to go, God, what is it that you have ahead of me? If you find yourself standing at the photocopier at work or boiling the kettle for another cup of coffee, just take that moment. Whether life is good and we've got an abundance to celebrate, and we are just full of party poppers and balloons and everything is brilliant, or whether actually, like today remind us, life is really rather rubbish. And there is some really awful stuff out there. Maybe that we're having to work through and deal with ourselves, or maybe those close to us having to grapple with. May we come to God in prayer, our will seeking to align with the things God has for us. I want to pray. I'm going to pray a prayer that Pete Gregg references in his book, How to Pray. I was meant to have a copy here to wave at you, but I haven't. It's upstairs in my office. A really helpful book. If you're wanting just again to explore kind of a lot of different facets of prayer and how we can continue to work into this. This is a prayer by Francis Fenelon, and it's a prayer of relinquishment. And it's a prayer that just says, I want to let go and let God. I want to give myself over to you and your will to be done. Let's just take a moment just to be still, and then I'm just going to pray this. And as is kind of the norm, if you want to say amen at the end, you can. But don't say it lightly. Lord, I do not know what to ask you. Only you know what I need. I simply present myself to you. I give my heart to you. I have no other desire than to accomplish your will. Teach me to pray.